Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Britain plans to deport a Muslim cleric who has been called Osama bin Laden's ambassador in Europe, and that's despite objections from human rights activists. Abu Qatada is among 10 people whom British officials slated for deportation today under tough new anti-terrorism laws. Joining us on the line from London is David Barrett, Home Affairs correspondent for the British Press Association. And David, I've read that Abu Qatada is very influential. There are claims, for instance, that he inspired 9/11 hijacker Mohammed Atta, but he's less known than some other radical clerics, yes?
His name has become more prominent in the last few months, but he's far from being a household name. Some of the things he's said in recent years have caused a storm, and there are a lot of people, certainly in the Muslim community, who I think will be quite pleased to see the developments today.
I understand that he's been held without charges for 3 years now, yes?
It's slightly more complicated than that. He went on the run shortly after these 9/11 atrocities because he could see that the British government were planning on putting people like him into internment. That's imprisonment without charge or trial. He was on the run for about 10 months and was eventually arrested by the police and put into a high-security prison for several years. But earlier this year, the laws which allowed him to be interned were ruled illegal, and he was released onto a kind of house arrest, and that's where he's been until today.
What is Abu Qatada charged with?
He's not actually charged with anything. It's not a criminal matter. What the situation is that the British Home Secretary, Charles Clarke, within his powers, can say that certain people are a threat to national security. And if they are not British nationals, he is within the Home Secretary's powers, effectively to say, you're out. And that's what's starting to happen in this situation. There is, however, a lengthy legal process involved. So this is very much the beginning of a long process.
And I'm another radical cleric who's also lived in London for years. Omar Bakri was arrested in Lebanon today. What do you know about that?
Omar Bakri is another well-known figure in the UK. He's been very outspoken. And last week, the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, announced a further crackdown on fundamentalism supporters who appear to back terrorism. And on Saturday, Bakri left the UK and went to visit his mother, apparently, in Beirut. We don't quite know what's happened today. The Lebanese authorities haven't said a lot, and it's difficult to know what's going to happen.
Why are human rights activists concerned about these deportations?
The human rights activists are concerned that Britain is thinking about deporting the 10 who've been detained today to countries which have a very poor human rights record, countries such as Jordan and Algeria, which is another country that the British government is negotiating with, have been known to use torture on their prisoners and on others. And the British government has tried to get round this by signing agreements or attempting to sign agreements with these countries that torture won't be used. The civil rights people say that these agreements aren't worth the paper they're written on, and that's why the attempt to deport these 10 will be fought in the courts.
Mm-hmm. What's been the response from the public, and particularly from Muslim groups, about some of these deportations?
There is a mixed response. Some of the personalities involved are seen to be extreme. They are seen to be damaging to the British Muslim population in general. But on the other hand, the Muslim population believes, like many others, that it's wrong to deport people to countries where they may be tortured or even killed. So it's not clear cut.
Okay. Overall, what's the feeling like right now in London?
People in London and in Britain generally will be quite glad, I think, to see that apparent progress is being made, and we could see these people expelled from the country if that's what the courts decide. And that is a very significant development, because these men have been a problem for the British government for some years now, in fact since the day after 9/11, and this is the, if not the final chapter, it's certainly the beginning of the end.
David Barrett is Home Affairs Correspondent for the British Press Association. Next week, more than 1,500 Israeli families are under order to leave their homes in settlements in Gaza and the West Bank. While many Palestinians look forward to their departure, concerns remain about whether the Palestinian Authority is prepared to provide security and control militant groups like Hamas. Khalil Shikaki is a political analyst and director of the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research in Ramallah. Khalil, how are Palestinians viewing the upcoming withdrawal of Israeli settlers from Gaza?
I think at the moment the expectations are very high, although initially there were a lot of misgivings about the step. Despite the welcoming environment, most Palestinians, of course, are very happy that Israel is evacuating all of its settlements in the Gaza Strip and is pulling back to the lines of 1967. These two demands have been made by Palestinians throughout the last 30 years of Israeli occupation. So Palestinians are certainly welcoming it. But, of course, it's not that simple. Palestinians are also concerned that when the Israelis pull out, Israel will keep its control over the external envelope of the Gaza Strip, making life miserable for Palestinians in Gaza. And that Israel is also pulling out from Gaza because it intends to build more settlements in the West Bank, and that it hopes that the international community would not be as tough with Israel in terms of building settlements in the West Bank if Israel has pulled out of the Gaza Strip. Moreover, a lot of Palestinians also believe that Israel is pulling out from Gaza because of the violence, that this is victory for violence. Put together, this seems to be a very complicated Palestinian perception of the whole process. But of course, now that everyone is expecting this to happen within the next couple of weeks, there is, I believe, a great deal of expectations.
And what about the Palestinian Authority? Is the Palestinian Authority ready to administer things successfully at this point? Do most Palestinians feel confident that the Palestinian Authority will be able to do this?
No. Most Palestinians believe the Palestinian Authority is not ready to take control of the Gaza Strip. Most believe that the Palestinian Authority's ability to using its own security services to control the different armed groups and factions is very limited, and most Palestinians are not sure that the Palestinian Authority has the capacity to continue to deliver services to Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Authority seems confident that it can, but most Palestinians at the moment are not sure. Only one-third of the public is sure that the Palestinian Authority has the capacity to control the Gaza Strip and to continue to deliver services.
And what about Israel? What indications are you getting from Israel that it is committed to supporting this pullout after it happens?
At the moment, the Israelis are engaged in discussions with the Palestinians on different levels, dealing with issues related to coordinating security arrangements, as well as economic and civil matters.
What's the economic situation in Gaza like right now?
It's terrible. Per capita income is about $600. In the West Bank, it's almost double that amount. The unemployment rate in Gaza is about 40%. In the West Bank, it's about half of that, perhaps a little bit more. The Gazans rely heavily on their ability to export agricultural products. But at the moment, and of course, if the Israelis do take Gaza out of the customs envelope, then the Gazans won't be able to continue to export these products to Israel or the West Bank. And this will certainly immediately affect the economic conditions. Many Gazans have been working in the one of the industrial parks inside the Gaza Strip, that was able to produce manufactured goods for Israeli and Palestinian companies, and that has been closed down. 4,000 people used to work there. 4,000 people have also been working in the greenhouses that belong to the settlements in Gaza, and they too will lose their jobs once the greenhouses are brought down. So the economic conditions are miserable.
Mr. Shekaki, you mentioned that the majority of Palestinians view this pullout plan as a victory for the armed resistance. Can you tell me basically what it looks like now in terms of prospects for peace between militant groups after the pullout and looking forward to the January elections that were announced by Mahmoud Abbas this week?
There is absolutely no doubt that there is a link between the perception of the disengagement as victory for violence and the possible outcome of the elections set now for January. As I said, the majority, actually it's between 70-75% of the public who believe that the Israelis are pulling out from the Gaza Strip because of the violence, that this is victory for armed struggle. Now, those who benefit from this, of course, are those who have advocated violence and those who have carried out the violence. This certainly isn't the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, who had actually condemned the violence and said it was destructive to Palestinian interests. So he cannot own the violence that led in the minds of the Palestinians to this disengagement. Therefore, he cannot own disengagement. Hamas, on the other hand, and other nationalist, militant nationalist groups such as Al-Aqsa Brigades, will certainly claim victory and claim the ownership of the disengagement from Gaza because of that prevailing public perception.
Do you mark this as a turning point for the Palestinians?
Absolutely it is. This is the first time in 36 years that Palestinians will be fully free from Israeli occupation, assuming that the Israelis indeed will carry out a complete withdrawal from Gaza. The first time the Palestinians will be able to govern themselves. Certainly, the fact that they are going to have elections immediately after that gives them the opportunity to try and transform their own expectations, their own desires to build a state into reality. And I believe, compared to where the Palestinians were, even after they reached the Oslo Agreement in 1993 with the Israelis, this is a definite turning point for them, as well as for the peace process.
And what about the position that the United States has taken thus far? How do most Palestinians view the U.S. role in all of this?
Most Palestinians do not see a very strong American leadership because of the absence of a political mission. What is really needed for the U.S. To really have an influence on the outcome of the current discussions is to have a political mission where the views of the U.S. president are clearly communicated to the two sides.
Mr. Shekaki, thanks very much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Khalil Shekaki is director of the Palestinian Center on Policy and Survey Research. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. We're continuing our conversation about the upcoming withdrawal of Israeli settlers from Gaza. Earlier this week, we spoke with Rachel Saperstein, a settler who's refusing to leave. Today, we're joined by Salah Abdel Shafi, a Palestinian who's lived in Gaza for 15 years. He's an economist and advises the Palestinian Authority on development issues. Mr. Abdel Shafi, will the withdrawal of Israeli settlers from Gaza make life better for Palestinians living there?
Well, definitely it will, because simply settlements in the Gaza Strip are occupying at least 25% of the land. They're controlling very important water resources. So by freeing up this space, this will give Palestinians in the Gaza Strip more space for urban development, for agricultural activities, for industries. But definitely this is not enough, because if Israel leaves Gaza and turn Gaza into a prison, which means not allowing people to move freely, then probably these gains will end up leading to a further deterioration of the economic situation. So a precondition for a sustainable improvement is really the freedom of access and movement of Palestinians and goods from and to the Gaza Strip after Israeli withdrawal.
All right, let's talk about the economy for a moment. Earlier in the show, we heard from Khalil Shikaki that the economy in Gaza is terrible, 40% unemployment rate. You're an economist. Do you think that the Palestinian leadership will be able to create jobs for the people who are there?
Well, the Palestinian Authority is supposed to create a conducive environment for investment. The Palestinian Authority is not supposed to create jobs. But the Palestinian Authority definitely has, first of all, to impose law and order. The rule of law is something very important. Second, it has to have a legal and regulatory framework that is conducive to development. And third, it should initiate a public investment program for infrastructure, roads, electricity, telecommunications. If the Palestinian Authority manages to do all of this, then we expect private investors, whether Palestinians or even foreign investors, to come and invest in Gaza and then create jobs and provide job opportunities for many unemployed Palestinians.
And do you think that the Palestinian Authority is prepared to take some of these steps right now?
Yes, I think the Palestinian Authority is prepared to take such steps. But I have to say that the Palestinian Authority is still very weak. You know, after 5 years of a low-intensity war, the Palestinian Authority still lacks a lot of resources. Still, the Palestinian Authority needs to reform itself, to reform the administration. We've experienced in the past a lot of corruption cases, mismanagement. But I think the new Palestinian leadership is aware of the need to reform itself and to strengthen its institutions so that they can deliver and prove to the people that that their daily lives will improve after this engagement.
And what about security issues? We've heard that once the settlers leave, that militant groups will likely move into Gaza. You live there. Are you concerned about security and about that potential?
I wouldn't really panic about this. I don't really think that we will be seeing a complete chaos and anarchy and military confrontations, although I do not really rule out certain incidents here and there.
You mentioned that there are some concerns about whether Israel will allow freedom of movement within Gaza. Israeli officials have said that they would not use this pullout as a way to consolidate control over the West Bank. I'm wondering, are there suspicions about that as well, and overall suspicions about how this is going to be carried out on the Israeli side of things?
Yes, you see, the disengagement is a unilateral decision by Sharon, by the Israeli Prime Minister Sharon, by the Israeli government. It was not negotiated with the Palestinian Authority. And I think this disengagement plan is part of a political strategy for Israel to really keep major parts of the West Bank, of the Palestinian-occupied West Bank, to continue with settlement policies in the West Bank, to continue the construction of the separation wall in the West Bank that cuts through Palestinian territory. That's why I'm really a bit concerned about the real intentions of the Israeli government, and that's why I really not very optimistic that Israel would really allow freedom of movement, a connection, a territorial link between Gaza and the West Bank. And this is why we hope that the international community and primarily the American administration would step in and tell the parties to go back to the negotiating table and talk about how to move forward politically.
And what's the mood in Gaza like right now?
Well, people, I have to say, are excited, are happy. They're looking forward for, this withdrawal, dismantling of settlements, evacuation of settlers. You see, settlements represent the ugliest face of occupation for Palestinians. People suffered a great deal from the presence of settlements and settlers. So definitely people are happy and looking forward for the day after.
Salah Abdel Shafi is a Palestinian who's lived in Gaza for 15 years. He spoke with us today from his home there. Next week on Here and Now, we'll continue our coverage of Israel's historic withdrawal from Gaza and a small part of the West Bank. The deadline for settlers to leave is this Monday. If they refuse, the Israeli army is under orders to begin forcible evictions 2 days later. This marks the first time Israel has dismantled Jewish settlements in Gaza and the West Bank since these territories were captured by Israel during the 1967 Mideast War. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. New details are emerging today about what the September 11th Commission knew about a secret military operation that apparently had identified Mohammed Atta and three other 9/11 hijackers more than a year before the terrorist attacks. The New York Times is reporting today that a uniformed military officer briefed Commission staff members last summer about Mohammed Atta, but the group did not include that information in its final report. Joining us on the line is the reporter who broke the story, Doug Jale. He's Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Welcome, Doug.
Thank you.
Can you start by telling us what Commission staff was apparently told?
The Commission acknowledges today that they were told in July 2004 that this secret military unit, Able Danger, had identified a so-called cell in the United States in the summer of 2000 and that its members included Mohammed Atta.
And you found out that this was the second time that the Commission staff members were briefed about this, yes?
There remains a discrepancy about the first incident. In October 2003, a former defense intelligence official has told me that he briefed members of the commission in Afghanistan or Pakistan and mentioned Mohammed Atta. To date, the commission has said that the people who participated in that briefing don't recall Atta's name being mentioned. What the commission said yesterday about the second briefing was that, yes, in fact, they do recall Atta's name being mentioned last July.
And so initially, when the commission spokesman had said that there was not a briefing and now there's this acknowledgement, can you explain that discrepancy a little bit further?
I cannot. They had acknowledged the second briefing only after we presented them with claims by Congressman Kurt Weldon of Pennsylvania, who's tried to bring this issue to light. His office had told us that there had been a briefing last July, and when presented with that information, the commission confirmed it.
Congressman Weldon is leading the charge to call attention to this so-called Able Danger military unit, and he's accused the commission of deliberately ignoring the information from this military officer. Can you tell us about that?
Mr. Weldon has said that there were several cases in which either members of this unit or he and his staff tried to call the commission's attention to this unit. That said, the commission to date has acknowledged only that last July they heard about Mohammed Atta. They say that there were elements of the account they heard from that uniformed officer that were inconsistent with their knowledge about Atta, and for that reason they dismissed his account and did not include anything in the report. Mm-hmm. This all took place just days, and really frenetic days, before the final report was issued.
We spoke with Commission member Richard Benveniste yesterday, and he said that he believed Commission staffers had never been told about this intelligence on Mohammed Atta. Do you think that there may have been some kind of disconnect between the staffers and the Commission members?
I think it's unclear what information was passed from the staffers to the Commission members. I think it's clear that the staffers heard more in two separate briefings about Able Danger. But how much of that information was passed on to the commission members itself is still unclear.
Mm-hmm. And the Pentagon thus far is silent on this.
The Pentagon has said it's doing its best to get to the bottom of this episode, but it doesn't yet have anything to report.
Basically, this story really is about the failure of intelligence in preventing the terrorist attacks. What kind of repercussions do you think this story will have? It doesn't sound like it's even close to being the end of it yet.
No, because there's much that remains unclear. And I am cautious, and I think we all should be cautious. No one has yet seen the document that members of this military unit claim to have given to superiors in the summer of 2000 recommending that it be shared with the FBI. So exactly what the military was told, what decisions were made about what to share and not share, and what information was provided to the 9/11 Commission all remains unclear. I guess at minimum, though, I would say that these accounts, if true, would change the history of what we know about the run-up to the September 11th attacks and would tell us that there were elements of the government that, in at least some way, had tried to raise a flag about Atta and others long before the attacks took place.
Doug Gell is Washington correspondent for The New York Times. Doug, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
The first advertisement attacking Supreme Court nominee John Roberts is now running on national television. The group NARAL Pro-Choice America is spending $500,000 for airtime. Let's take a listen.
7 years ago, a bomb destroyed a woman's health clinic in Birmingham, Alabama.
When a bomb ripped through my clinic, I almost lost my life. I will never be the same.
Supreme Court nominee John Roberts filed court briefs supporting violent fringe groups and a convicted clinic bomber.
I am determined to stop this violence, so I'm speaking out.
Call your senators. Tell them to oppose John Roberts. America can't afford a justice whose ideology leads him to excuse violence against other Americans.
But is that ad accurate? Well, we spoke with Brooks Jackson, who's director of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan group that goes through political ads with a fine-tooth comb. Brooks, is it accurate?
No, we're characterizing that as false, and we don't do that very often. This ad says Judge Roberts supports violent fringe groups and a bomber, and he excuses violence, and it's just not correct.
NARAL Pro-Choice America says, however, it's important to point out who Roberts is because the stakes are high in the battle over reproductive rights, and says that Roberts indirectly did support a convicted bomber.
Well, their ad doesn't say he indirectly supported anything. Their ad said he excuses violence. And in fact, they know that's wrong. Nancy Keenan, their president, said when they announced this ad, "I know he said he finds bombing and murder abhorrent." So they know he finds bombing and murder abhorrent, and yet they run this ad.
Do you think that we'll see more ads like this?
I don't know. Certainly both sides, the right and the left, have stockpiled millions of dollars in preparation for a fight, and if this is the opening volley, it doesn't bode very well. I can't say what the future's going to hold.
All right. Well, thanks very much for speaking with us.
All right. My pleasure, Deborah.
Brooks Jackson is with FactCheck.org. He's commenting about a new television ad on Supreme Court nominee John Roberts. And this note from the world of rock and roll, it seems neoconservatives won't be getting any satisfaction from the Rolling Stones' upcoming album. The band that helped define rock and roll is taking shots at the Bush administration with its new song, Sweet Neocon. The lyrics include lines like, "You call yourself a Christian, I call you a hypocrite." Stones lead singer Mick Jagger says it's nothing personal, he just wanted to express his political views. Here's Jagger speaking on the television show Extra.
It's certainly very critical of certain policies of this administration. Well, so what? You know, lots of people are critical.
The song never mentions President Bush or the war in Iraq, but it does make reference to military contractor Halliburton, which was formerly run by Vice President Dick Cheney. Sweet Neocon is a track on the Stones' upcoming album, A Bigger Bang, which will be released September 6th. The song is sure to be heard when the Stones kick off their U.S. tour right here in Boston, August 21st. You're listening to Here and Now. The NCAA has banned the use of American Indian mascots by sports teams during the association's postseason tournaments. But during regular season play, teams like the Central Michigan Chippewas and the Florida State Seminoles will be allowed to use their nicknames, mascots, and logos. Vernon Belcourt is a member of the Ojibwe Nation and president of the National Coalition on Racism in Sports and Media. Only a Game's Bill Littlefield asked Belcourt what he thought of the mandate.
We welcome their decision. It's a start, and it should be a message to all high school, colleges, universities across the country, as well as the Big Four, Cleveland, Atlanta baseball, Washington football, and, of course, Kansas City football. But it's going to have a big impact on University of Illinois, University of Utah, University of North Dakota, and, of course, the Florida State Seminoles.
There is quite a range in mascots of some of the schools mentioned in the NCAA's new policy. The Florida State mascot, the Seminole, rides onto the field on a horse and throws a fiery spear into the ground. But the Arkansas State Indians mascots are an Indian family. That is, according to the athletic director there, dignified, I'm using his word. As far as you're concerned, is there a meaningful distinction between these?
Well, I would like to know who that family is. You know, we have the biggest tribe in the country is the wannabe tribe, a self-hating people for whoever they are. They always want to identify with the romanticism and mysticism of being, quote, Indian. But in terms of Florida State, it's totally outrageous. Osceola was a great leader, a man of peace. He was betrayed by the original settlers in Florida, and eventually he was murdered. And now for them to say they're honoring Indian people by having this student hop on a horse and ride around the field and stick a flaming lance into the 50-yard line, that's Hollywood.
How is it, then, that some of the members of the Seminole tribe welcome the use of the nickname Seminoles at Florida State and all of the kind of pomp and circumstance that goes with it?
Well, first of all, they have a large gift shop at their casinos where they sell all this paraphernalia, so they have an economic interest. And, of course, in our history, there became a term called the hang around the fort Indian. These were the Indian people that came hang around the fort and get the crumbs that were thrown outside the fort. We have them today. We still have people hanging around the fort, and they have every right to express their feelings and to take this position. But I know a lot of Seminoles who are totally opposed to this kind of practice.
The president of Florida State University, T.K. Wetherill, has announced that he will try to get the NCAA's decision overturned. I gather that's something you'll be watching with considerable attention.
Well, of course. You know, there were people that thought slavery and segregated lunch counters and facilities were part of America for over 300 years. And they had to change. Yet there are people that want to now reverse NCAA's ruling. And we don't believe that that they will allow it to be reversed. I think it was a good ruling. It was the correct thing to do. And we wholeheartedly support NCAA.
And you have said you hope they'll go further and encourage, if not mandate, that these schools eliminate the mascots and that sort of thing in regular season play as well.
Well, here in Minnesota, when we parents of school children who were being abused at school where they had team names like Savages, Redskins, they took this issue on in 1985. There were 50-some high schools. All of them except a handful have changed with a good outcome. And we hope that now these institutions, in view of NCAA's ruling, will begin the dialogue and come up with a name, a new mascot, a new winning spirit, come out of the dugout, come out of the locker room, and become winners instead of losers, as long as they want to try to protect the status quo and continue to play Indian with our culture. They're going to end up losers, all of them.
Vernon Belcourt is the president of the National Coalition on Racism in Sports and Media. Mr. Belcourt, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
And thanks, too, to Only a Game's Bill Littlefield. Coming up, we remember publishing giant John Johnson. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. What began with a $500 loan almost 60 years ago is now the largest Black-owned and operated publishing company in the world. John H. Johnson, who built this empire and whose publications included Jet, Ebony, and Negro Digest, died this week at the age of 87. As we remember Johnson, we're joined by Tavis Smiley, television and radio host. Hello and welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, Deborah. Nice to be here and now. Glad that you are here and now.
Tavis, you knew John Johnson personally, and I've heard him described as a kind man, a shrewd businessman, a genius at defining the collective unconscious of African Americans as a whole. How would you describe him? What kind of person was he?
All of the above and then some, Deborah. He was an authentic American hero whose entrepreneurial exploits, I think, will be dissected and certainly discussed for many years to come. He had an abiding love for Black people that was always on display, and he died still owning 100% of everything. In other words, he didn't just talk the talk, he walked the walk.
Hmm. I also heard that when he was first starting out, he was told that a Black magazine would never sell. So he must have been rather confident, willing to take risks.
Very confident, willing to take risks, and not just that, but the stories, I mean, over the years I've had a chance to sit literally at his feet, at his office, and at his house, and just learn from him and hear these stories. He has a book that he wrote some years ago, his life story called Succeeding Against the Odds. It is a book that I highly recommend because it really does tell the genius of one of America's great entrepreneurs, one of America's great capitalists. When you get your mother to mortgage the only thing she owns so you can get a $500 loan, and with that $500, all you buy is paper, stamps, and envelopes, and you use the 20,000-person mailing list that the owner of a Black insurance company has given you permission to use, and you send a letter that says, "Dear Deborah, a friend of yours told me that you'd appreciate getting a magazine every month that chronicled the life, the accomplishments, and the contributions of Black people." That letter was ingenious because it came with about 3,000 or 4,000 subscriptions for a magazine that had yet to go to print. And the rest, as they say, 60 years later, is history. But along the way, there are all kinds of amazing stories about how he became the only African-American to this day who still owns a high-rise building on Michigan Avenue in Chicago. The stories of going to a state dinner at the White House one night and being mistaken for a driver who was parking cars, and there he was as a guest at the White House. I mean, he's had to go through so much starting this company during the years of segregation to 60 years later still own it and have never been forced out of business, never been forced to sell a single share of your operation is a significant story, again, that we'll be talking about for years to come.
Right, right. How did you meet John Johnson?
I met him because as a kid, I, of course, grew up like everybody else. You cannot be Black and not have an Ebony or a Jet story. And so it was always my dream one day as a kid to do something that would make a contribution to my community. And sure enough, that opportunity came when I was in my early 20s, about 24, 25. Ebony Magazine selected me as one of Black America's future leaders. That was long before I ever made the cover of Newsweek and Time, which I've been blessed to do. And after being featured in Time and Newsweek, I then later appeared in Jet Magazine. And the funny story is that inside of Black America, the cover of Time and Newsweek was important, but in my own family, certainly, it didn't mean anything to them that I'd been on the cover of Time and Newsweek. But when I made the cover of Jet Magazine, oh my God, that was something that was something to talk about. And that's the reaction that anybody Black has. So after I appeared in the magazine once, I wrote him a letter and asked for the opportunity to meet him. He agreed. I came to Chicago at my expense to meet him, and that started a long friendship. And I've been honored by his family to be asked to speak at his funeral.
Oh, really? And his funeral is Monday, yes?
Funeral will be Monday, and I suspect that the creme de la creme, the cream of the crop in Black America, will be in attendance. And I know that on Sunday, which is fitting, I spoke to his daughter, Linda, when she first called me to ask me to speak at the funeral. And I said to her almost immediately, I said, "Linda, I don't know what the family's plans are, but that building and his legacy in Chicago and around the world is so important. You all need to consider letting his body lie in the lobby of the building and let people file in and around to see him, to pay their last respects, and to do it in a place that is a part of history." And so I don't know if it was my suggestion or what, but they agreed to do that. So his body will lie Sunday in the Johnson Building, and the funeral services will be on Monday.
Hmm. His work, what about influencing you in your career to stay in a career, a field rather, that's a white-dominated field, particularly like broadcasting?
Yeah. Somebody once said, and I have come to learn what these words mean and to make them, quite frankly, Deborah, the mantra, the mission statement of my own life. Somebody once said that the essence of my life is commitment. The successes and failures are but mere byproducts. The essence of my life is commitment. The successes and failures are but mere byproducts. I've come to live by that credo for many years now, and Mr. Johnson's life speaks to that. And when you get into this white, male-dominated broadcast world, particularly with the images that exist of black people, you have to have the courage and the conviction and the commitment to stick with it.
Tavis, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time, Deborah.
Tavis Smiley is a public radio and television host. Poet and writer Nikki Giovanni also had ties to John Johnson. She was first published in one of his periodicals. Welcome, Nikki.
Oh, thank you.
When we talk about Johnson's magazine empire and publications like Jet and Ebony and Negro Digest, did you have these magazines around when you were growing up?
Oh, absolutely. Jet magazine was the magazine that you always, it was our Newsweek. You always had to have a Jet magazine. You go to the beauty parlor every Saturday and you would, people like me, I'd sit and read the Jet. But honestly, for me, the most important magazine was actually Negro Digest. It's fair to say the Negro Digest was the mind of the black arts movement. You look at all of the writers, Alice Walker, all of us who first published in the Negro Digest, and that's where we shared ideas. It was our communication vehicle.
Jet magazine, that was the first place where the public saw pictures of the corpse of Emmett Till, the black teenager who was lynched in Mississippi in 1955. Can you describe what kind of risk was it to publish a photo like that at the time?
I think that John Johnson had to be a very brave man. He was, of course, a Republican, as many black men of his generation were. But he also had a radical side. Look at what he allowed Jet to do in publishing those photos, because it had to cost him advertisers. You know, there were people that did not want to admit that that was Emmett, first of all, and that this is what America had done to him. Emmett's mother, you know, was from Chicago, Mrs. Bradley, and her statement was, "I want the world to see what they did to my son." And, of course, she opened the casket, and when she did, Monita Sleet and other photographers went in there and just and plastered it. And they said to John Johns, you know, we have to do this. And he said, hey, do it. And I think that my whole generation just looked at it and said, well, if this is what you do to a 14-year-old, what are you going to do to us? And all of us, I think you talk to Julian Bond, you talk to Kwayisi Mfuma, you talk to Medgar Evers, all of us were radicalized by looking at that photograph because we recognized that it could be us. And I'm saying that to say that, you know, we watched the Iraq war and we watched the president say we're not going to show you the coffins coming home because it upsets people. So for John Johnson to take that was a very, very courageous stand.
And what role do you think his publications had in the civil rights movement?
I think the movement would have been radically different without Jet and without Digest particularly. Jet was always a national magazine. It was the little magazine that you carried and that you passed along. You must have a pass-along rate on Jet even yet of maybe 10. Maybe 10 people read the same Jet because people will sit there in the beauty parlors, in the barbershops, and they'll say, well, what was in Jet this week? Even today, I can say, what's on the cover of Ebony? And some people know, some people don't, but they can all tell me what's in Jet.
Well, Nikki, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Nikki Giovanni is a poet, teacher, and writer. Her latest book is Rosa, a biography of Rosa Parks for children.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
A change gonna come.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.